What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Sound Money Podcast. I am your host, Steve McGarry, and today I sit down with the one and only Crypto Blood. He has an amazing software engineering background. He's based in Detroit. He's a good friend of mine, and let's go through our conversation. It's about 45 minutes long about some of the old school things that were going on in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space back in 2013, 2014. And without further ado, let's dive into my interview with Crypto Blood.
It's been like a year, right, since we've been on together.
Yeah, that's right, man. We were talking while there was blood in the water. There was a lot of silence in the space. And when we spoke last, we talked about like Cripsy, Big Vern, like all these old exchanges. And like when Gox went down, it was pretty chaotic, and then it was silent for a while after that.
Yeah, it was. And good pick again. I forgot to say this for the second time. Good pick on the song request, Kevin Gates, Two Phones. This is a classic right here.
That's definitely right.
A classic that we're rocking out to that. But yeah, man, Big Vern, all those, man, those are back in the days. Like, what do you think about, because you've been in crypto for a while then, so I forgot. What do you feel is going on now, man? Like, how do you feel about cryptos nowadays, the whole industry as a whole? Like, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, I feel optimistic about a lot of the things that people are building out. I think that, you know, there was a project years ago in 2014, it was called CoinGen. And for all the OGs out there, CoinGen was like just a fork that you could quickly create an altcoin. And I messaged back and forth with Richie from Bittrex and literally got a CoinGen coin listed on Bittrex within a few hours of doing it. And, you know, free of charge, just messaging back and forth on Bitcoin Talk, the forum where everybody used to communicate.
Yeah.
And
that's where all the, you know, back then it wasn't ICOs. It was just like new coin publishers. And it was yeah. That was like the format. You had to put it on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You put your supply, your float and all that.
That's right. That's right. And it was much more of a communal effort.
It was. And that's what I was trying to get to with my question. It's kind of a loaded kind of question. Like, I don't feel that anymore in the game, in the crypto community.
Industry. Yeah, and I think that that's just a product of like a ton of people coming into the space, you know, when there was a ton of hype, and that's always going to happen. And there's a lot of really brilliant minds in the space, and the concept of a pecking order where it's just everybody in this tiny little space is all pecking at each other and arguing about these different things within a tiny, tiny, tiny little subset of the world. And it has drifted a little bit away from what feels like a communal all boats rise effort, where it's like a cohesive win when we all come out with something new. Every time Crypto Blood comes out with a video, everybody's sharing it to show support across the community. Right. Those types of things were what used to feel like. And it was like everyone all together trying to get the word out. And now it's become a little bit more tribal, it feels like, with people looking inward into the community instead of trying to look outward, which is a bizarre thing to watch. But
it seems like a money grab now.
Yeah, a lot of trading, a lot of traders out there. And I mean, it's just how things are playing out. I mean, we don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years from now. Nobody knows what's going to happen, which is kind of the magic. You know, nobody knows. If people claim that they do know, they're not.
Yeah, they don't know, because we didn't know back then. We didn't know what was going to come of this whole experiment. It felt like a huge ass experiment at that point.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I think even so, more so on the, when I say money grab, not even so much for the individual participants in the crypto game. I think I'm more so talking about all these corporations, all of these Wall Street guys and organizations jumping in on this. It just seems weird, man. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like the community, and I guess that's why it doesn't feel like that close-knit community we used to have, because we have these mega corporations trying to, you know, capitalize off of blockchain, you know, and or Bitcoin in particular, especially like the Wall Street guys.
So, yeah, and it is kind of sad seeing some of the older projects going out. Like, I don't know if you read that Vertcoin got 51% attacked this past week.
Yeah, I saw that.
I mean, Vertcoin was one of the first core wallets I ever downloaded, and I was super excited about it. It had a huge community back then, you know, a few thousand people, and I remember being so excited about the whole thing. I was like, this is so cool, and altcoin has so much hype next to Bitcoin, like this is wild. So it was kind of, I don't know if they're still, do you know anything if they're still continuing on after the attack?
I don't know if they're going to continue or not. I just saw the headline and did see that, so I'm not too sure if it's going to continue or not. I don't see any information on it at the moment.
Yeah, because that feels like the end of a end of an era if people are still actively mining Vertcoin, and then somebody came in and I think they rented a bunch of hash power from NiceHash and just 51'd it.
They've been doing that more often lately, being able to use cloud mining to really leverage up, you know, and hack and 51% a lot of these smaller coins.
Yeah, you know? and it wasn't profitable. Like I think the math was like it took the attacker 0.4 Bitcoin to do the attack, and I think if they would have dumped everything, it would have been half a Bitcoin. So it was like only a couple hundred dollars, if maybe $1,000 to attack it. And I don't know. I feel like doing something like that just seems out there to me.
How do you feel about even we're talking about like a change in the crypto space? How do you feel about the direction that Bitcoin is actually going in? Do you because again, you're an OG, so you can kind of understand and see the transformation and the evolution. And change is normal. That's change is what we have in life, right? The only thing constant is change.
Yeah.
But you're either changing for the good or changing for the worse, you know? And I just wanted to get your opinion on Bitcoin's evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, after Gox, you know, a lot of people watching and listening to this that were around when that happened, I mean, people thought it was over. People legitimately just thought that the whole thing was completely, that the experiment of Bitcoin was done. Like, there was so much negativity in the space. It was unreal. And you remember that. And it was crazy, because people that had a lot of money in it, you know, were panicking, watching those Reddit posts. I still have one indexed on my laptop. That's from back then. People saying that they had dumped everything that they had and capitulated to get out. Because they
And were remember ch- back then when Mt. Gox did get hacked? CNBC comes out of nowhere and says Bitcoin was hacked. You know, they were using that narrative instead of saying like the exchange was hacked.
Yeah.
That lingered on for like a year and a half or so. I don't know if you want to call it disinformation or misinformation. Not sure. But whatever way, whatever method, it definitely deterred, you know, newcomers. Because they thought that this new technology, this new coin, could be hacked.
Yeah, that was a rough time for sure. So I still have not seen anything like that happen in recent years. Like, that was by far the apocalypse, where everybody thought, all right, this thing's going to zero. This thing is just totally done for, because the biggest exchange was done. Like, this would be like if Binance and Coinbase went down, and back then in relative terms. So it was like just a total nightmare scenario for everybody that was already involved, seeing things like CNBC coming out and spreading this information, and businesses like Schrems company, BitInstant, you know, going down, like all these companies that had customers in crypto, that just, it was a nightmare scenario. So I have not seen anything like that relived, which is good. I look at that as a good thing.
Yeah.
And zooming out, you know, in terms of everything fundamental to Bitcoin, it looks good. I mean, we're still seeing like decent hash and decent mining. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's like a lot of argument around centralization with mining and things like that.
Yeah.
But
let's talk about that. How do you feel about that as far as, because it is centralized in my book. If you want to just be technical, technically speaking, it is very centralized, and it's centralized between three entities, all of which are in China. Mm-hmm. Two of them, I believe, are actually owned by one entity.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
So I talked about this on my stream with Richard Hart last week, and he like laughed at this theory that's out there. And the theory is that the current financial system works on transactions. Like a bank makes a lot of its money from fees, like transaction fees, and payment mm-hmm. processors exist because they make off of a transaction fee. To facilitate mm-hmm. a transaction, they make money. And the theory is in a, like a dystopian futuristic world, mm-hmm. banks will become the mining centralized areas where they are confirming transactions and taking those fees mm-hmm. and keeping that business model of, you know, thriving off of people's transaction fees. And that is effectively what miners are doing by confirming blocks. And that theory is a wild one, that's how institutions and banks like central banks would contribute to the Bitcoin network, is they would just be miners. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's like way out there, but I think it's a fun thought exercise to think about what's currently surviving and the lifeblood of transaction fees. And that is the central bank institutions and the banking system very heavily surviving on that. So it's like, okay, what would happen if it shifted into that? And I don't think that it's an ideal scenario, because then they control transactions and things like that. But
at the same time, like, and this is what I've been like really stressing to people, like, I think there are still people in the community that think that this there will be at some point have this they have this idea of fully decentralized.
Yeah,
and I think that's a pie in the sky concept, and the reason why is because if you go that route, if you go fully, absolutely, fully decentralized, then you're going to have, when I say decentralized, I mean decentralized in governance or law. Like, you're going to have collusion. So how do you deal with collusion if you're just going to let it be a fully free market? You're going to have that happen. You're going to have, I mean, you see it with Bitcoin.
Yeah,
there's collusion in the mining industry.
Yeah, and what we saw.
How do you fix that? Do you fix that? Is it a you know? I mean, these are questions that I don't know if anyone has an answer to, but you know, these are issues that are coming up because we're dealing with a new technology.
Yeah, and like your hat EOS, you know, that a prime example of when they moved into DPoS, delegated proof of stake. And cartels started forming.
Correct. Like
people started working together. Exchanges had huge bags of EOS, so they were like, "All right,
still do.
We're gonna stake and be one of these producers. Like, why not?
Yeah, why not? Why not
work together with all the other exchanges?" And I think people had thought about it, but people didn't really think about it through practice and see how big of an issue it was gonna be.
Because you never know. When you in software development, and this is what it is, essentially, this is all software development. When you develop something, you don't know what to fix until you put it into the wild and mm-hmm. let the end user use it. And in this case, the end user is just the market utilizing this and figuring, seeing, you know, how the players in the market react and try to game the system.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening with EOS right now. It can be fixed, but, you know, those are unintended consequences that they didn't think about. And you can't think about everything.
Yeah. A new DPOS that's really interesting to me is Icon. I don't know if you've been following them. So I'm actually on a team that is a block producer, I guess you could call it, but it's a PREP or public representative that is a validator on their system. And it's very similar to EOS, where people vote top 22 representatives that help with governance of the network. Mm-hmm. And it's been really fun to watch that, like as a front row seat. And I've been helping with the AC3 is the team that I'm a part of. And we're partnered with Mousebelt. That's an accelerator program. And it's a lot of fun to watch what's going on, because unlike EOS, things haven't quite shifted in the direction of like big exchanges going on there. There was one that people were really upset about, but it was interesting to watch people just arguing over what's going on with the PREPs, how they're regulating or how they're governing the network. Proposals keep coming across our desk for like people that are trying to get funding for building apps and dApps. And it is cool to have a front row seat on what it looks like from the other side. But in terms of the one thing that I brought up earlier about the banks, there is this weird mentality, and similar to your point about how Bitcoin is changing, there is this concept now of that Bitcoin or just crypto in general will replace banks. And I just think that it's short-sighted for people to hear that and think about that, because if anything, they are going to get involved in something that's demanded by consumers in the economy. Consumers drive what businesses do. Like, consumption controls 70% of our GDP. Everything that we consume altogether drives what businesses are going, they react to our business, our consumption. So if you go to your bank and say, hey, are you guys going to hold my Bitcoin in the future? If everybody does that for a year, banks are eventually going to adjust and say like, yeah, sure, we'll hold your Bitcoin for you. We'll be your custodian.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be like, oh, we throw in the white towel, all of our billions in profit, we're done, Bitcoin wins. That's just not how the most powerful people in the entire world are going to react to a new technology. They're going to adopt it. They're going to bring it in-house. They're going to learn about it. They're going to help contribute to you as a consumer, mm-hmm. being able to use it. And once regulation and all that catches up, I just think it's not a, and this was another thing that I talked about on that previous live stream, was that just thinking that this is the one all solution and it's going to replace everything in the world, like the entire financial institution, is
not
just
going to. No. And I think we had that idea initially. I know I did. I think a lot of people in the community did, like, this Bitcoin was just going to be the world reserve currency, replace all fiat currency, bada boom, bada bang. just that simple.
All the days work.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just not, man. I had that idea. I had that naive stance as well. Now, no, I don't even think fiat currencies are going to be fully eliminated. I think they're going to just transfer into what I'm calling crypto fiat.
Yeah,
their own issued cryptocurrency, you know, and the masses will adopt it as they always do. You know, you push something on them, and because they don't know, most people don't understand what real money is, sound money is, and what it isn't. So I think they're going to adopt that. But I think that in that transformation, you're still going to see the Bitcoins of the world appreciate in value against all of those currencies, because they're going to be open-ended. They're going to be inflationary currencies, mm-hmm. unlike Bitcoin and some of these other ones. So,
yeah. And in most cases, I would even say that people in the future won't even know that the technology is operating in the background with those fiat crypto hybrid type things. Like they're not going to know that, like, the encryption technology that exists behind it, and they're not going to think about it. It's just going to be dollars, but it's just going to be a more technologically advanced way of using money. So agree.
Look at what I actually reported on this the other day, as far as Germany becoming a crypto haven. So they passed some laws, essentially it gives them the ability, banks there in Germany, the ability to store and sell cryptocurrencies. So there you have it, like something that's absolutely not necessary, but they're doing it. And the generation that came before us, they feel comfortable with that. That's what they know. They know banks. And so the banks are adopting, like you said, they're taking this technology and they're bringing it into their ecosystem.
Yeah. And there is from an economics perspective, there is a tipping point that happens where at a certain threshold in 5-10 years from now, the younger generations than both of us, and even after them, will have lived in a world where digital assets and cryptocurrencies have existed longer than without them. So there will be a time where it tips to the point where they're more comfortable using these things because they've been around them for their entire lives.
Yeah,
and
no, that makes sense.
That type of thing is gonna happen in the next, you know, 5-10 years. And one important point to mention, that part of the reason that I'm really into this space and very active on social media, is because millennials, or our generation, mm-hmm. In 2023, the average millennial will turn 35, mm-hmm. and we will only control 3% of the wealth. Now, with baby boomers, when they were 35, I believe they controlled, I think it was like 18%, mm-hmm. something like that. And Gen X. Yeah, Gen X, they controlled, I believe it was 10%. So it's a clear decline.
Correct.
And I'm very advocating for this space because I think the wealth creation that's going to happen in digital assets and cryptocurrencies over the next 5 and 10 years will change that wealth redistribution. Like, that wealth redistribution will happen with the younger digital age, and we can actually jump back on track potentially to
it's
something.
It's funny you talk about and you bring up baby boomers, because I just had Ted Seidel on. I was telling you mm-hmm. about before we recorded. He is his research and stuff, and it makes sense. He's like, people think that the baby boomers took it all, like they're gonna leave, you know, basically with it all while everything crumbles behind them. And he was like, actually, it's not the case. They're gonna be screwed just as much as the millennials because of pensions. And I said, wow, I didn't think about that. So it's the baby boomers are definitely taking the wealth with them, but it's a very small percentage of the baby boomers. It's not all of them. And, you know, he kind of helped me realize that. I'll have to send you a link to the interview, but
I
think. And so I said all that to say, I think that cryptos will be able to help those individuals as well. Those baby boomers that were relying on pensions and Social Security, can't say savings.
Yeah,
that doesn't do anything in a zero interest rate environment. But maybe, just maybe, cryptos can help buffer and give them some relief, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And just to fact check myself, even in 1989, boomers were 35 and they controlled 21% of the wealth. Gen X in 2008, they were 35 and they controlled 8% of the wealth.
Wow.
And in 2023, when the average millennial turns 35, we will own 3%. So it's a pretty steep decline. In terms
very
of
very steep decline.
Yeah, in terms
of the world. I did not know that.
Yeah, so I think that there will be a redistribution, and I think digital assets and crypto is the biggest potential to trigger that for younger people that are already digital, all on their phones. Everybody's always online, connected. It just makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, sometimes I get comments from because sometimes I have people on my channel that are non-crypto related. Mm-hmm. They're more experts in like precious metals and stuff. And so quite naturally, when I have them on, some of the comments I get will be from individuals that follow those people. And they'll say, well, what are you going to do when the power goes out? How are you going to use your cryptos then? I'm like, really? Like, you don't have $100,000 in your pocket right now. Yeah. All your money is in Bank of America notes, credits, JP Morgan credits. You know, you could you may have a small percentage of your net worth or liquidity in gold or silver, but come on, if the power goes out tomorrow, believe me, precious metals, cryptos, none of that is going to matter.
Yeah,
you know, you better have some guns.
Yeah,
and some you know, some food.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot of things that jump in front of money when the power goes out,
right?
In terms of priority, because that is that's a bleak situation if the whole world loses power simultaneously for a long period of time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No one's thinking about precious metals or crypto.
Yeah, and super nerdy on that one. I know people have developed a way to send Bitcoin via radio.
Low frequency waves, yeah.
And that wouldn't happen, but I mean, it could happen.
It may happen for a little bit I don't know, man. But yeah, theoretically, you can still transmit wealth.
We could hold antennas. We could hold antennas towards each other.
Exactly.
And send each other some crypto. But
if the power goes out, man, is and actually, I'll give you one even better. If the power goes out, guess what medium of exchange people will gravitate to? I would say, let's say it's like a extended outage. A year or two, people will actually gravitate toward dollars, like physical dollars, because that's what we know.
Yeah,
we know the value. We know how to place a value there. Everyone knows how to place a value on a dollar or a $10 bill or a $50 bill, or $20 bill. We know that.
Yeah,
gold. No, you go out and ask the average person. Right now, how much is this ounce of gold? They're going to say $200, $100. You know, they're going to be like, because the ounce of gold is very small. So people are going to be like, I don't know, $100 when it's $1,500, $1,600 right now.
Yeah. And if the power did go out, barter would definitely come into play where, you know, I got a pound of steaks or something and you got a pound of bread and we just swap or something like that.
Right.
And just play it, eyeball it, just like we used to do in like ancient times, eyeballing.
Yep. It'd be inefficient, but
just
have to eyeball it.
That's what we, I think that the one most interesting thing that I've heard about dollars recently was that it represents freedom. What are your thoughts on that? Where it's like
the dollar
represents freedom.
It does.
In terms of anonymity. And everything.
It does. It absolutely does. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they're getting better at clamping down on that type of stuff, cross-border transportation of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have more than 10K going through the airport, you have to report that. It's a form I have to fill out. and submit and everything before, or TSA is going to be hassling me. So they're getting, so the portability aspect of it across borders is becoming a little bit more difficult to handle and do. Even across state lines, like if you get caught with $50,000 by a state trooper under the Patriot Act, it's called forfeiture. They can take that money from you. It happens. It's happened to in my community as a black person. It's happened to many, whether or not the money was legal or not. You have street guys, money gone because they can't. They can't account for it. They can't show you the paper trail on that money. They can take that money under the Patriot Act. So, but yeah, it does. I mean, if you're talking about just in an everyday, day-to-day thing, operation, yeah, day-to-day life, absolutely. If you have, $1 million in $100 bills, you're pretty free.
Totally. And I think that the people that do have mattress money and they carry around cash regularly are the type of people that would enjoy something like a Bitcoin. I
I
think that
agree.
they're the most likely to understand the sovereignty of it, like that
Correct.
you're fully in control. If you have a wad of cash in your pocket, somebody comes and shoves you down and takes it, then it's the same thing as if
Yep.
you lost your private keys. It's the same self responsibility and self
Correct.
accountability that they're already comfortable with.
Yeah, and at this point, I would say cash is even more anonymous than Bitcoin. At this point, with all these technologies, all these groups that are chain analysis, chain analysis, doing all. So, if you don't know how to properly tumble and mix your coins and stuff, you can be in some trouble there.
That's right. So what do you think about the Virgil thing with Ethereum? What are your thoughts
Yeah.
on that?
I read the article. I read a couple of articles actually. Very stupid of him, in my opinion. He seemed like very arrogant or something. Because if you read in the article, it says that he actually mentioned that he wanted to go over there to sell them some type of crypto equipment, hardware or something. In
Really?
2000, yeah, in 2018 or 17, 18 or 17, and he was like, not, I don't know if he was bragging, but he was saying that he was going to do that, but he was warned not to. So that I think is when he was put on the list, like to be watched, and then he decides that he wants to go over there for this crypto conference or whatever. Again, warned not to, and chose to go anyway. Like, what are you doing?
And there's definitely, in terms of a lot of people are talking about freedom of speech and stuff like that, but it's a little bit of a gray area because he was actively showing people how to bypass sanctions that were put in place.
So I heard, okay, so I didn't, I heard that there were accounts or witnesses that said that he didn't try to do that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was nothing like that. But it doesn't matter. My whole point is, I'm not even talking about that part. Just the sheer fact that you decided to continue to go over there is going to put a spotlight on you in anyway. If you went over there just for educational purposes, why are you doing that when the government explicitly told you that is a country that is on the basically kind of like no fly zone? The sanctions are real tough over there in North Korea.
So what did he say exactly? Because if it's coming down to like what he was teaching
So
people.
I don't know what this account wasn't from him. This was from someone that was there, I believe, that said there was no type of stuff about sanctions and getting bypassing sanctions or anything. And you know, if you think about it, North Korea has very advanced technology and are already hacking. I heard that they were responsible for a large majority of the hacking in 2018 and 19 in crypto. So they already know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, that situation is really, really a, like I said, a gray area, because if he was actively telling people, like, if he even mentions, you know, these are ways that you can bypass laws and stuff like that using this technology, you know, it is a question of, is it on the person who implements it and does it, or is it on the teacher? Like, who is the who's the person at fault? Like, the guy who created, what was the name of the 3D printed gun? I forgot the name of the.
I remember that guy.
Oh boy, it was called something like the Liberator or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if people listening and watching haven't heard of that, he just created a CAD document that just allowed you to 3D print this gun, which you know, was technically his freedom of speech and his ability to just put it out on, I think, Pirate Bay was where he deployed it. But you know, it's a similar gray area where he was the guy who designed it and open sourced it and put it out there, and it was downloaded hundreds of thousands of times before they did their best to take it down. Because this was the type of thing that couldn't be detected on an airplane. This was the type of thing that could just be going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And to government, that was pretty much a big red flag there that they didn't want to have floating around on the internet. And it still floats around on the internet all over the place because it was out there for a while before it got taken down. But this is another...
What happens when we get to the point of decentralized internet, you know, when you can't take stuff down? It's going to be interesting.
Yeah,
it's really going to be interesting, because you're going to have, again, this is what I mean by, what does fully decentralized look like? Is that something that can even be implemented in the real world? Because if it's fully decentralized, that means I can have pedophile stuff on there.
Yeah,
I can have racist, Nazi, black supremacy, white supremacy. I can have any and everything will be able to be accessed on this decentralized internet. Is that something that we want? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the money that would be made would probably be around filtering. Like, you would be filtering through all of the cesspool of, like, hate and the stuff that you don't want to see. I'm sure that, I don't know, that is once again another gray area where it's like, do you want it? Do you not want it? And people would advocate for that they want it, but they only want the good stuff. They don't
That's
want
what
the
I'm
bad
saying.
Stuff.
You're right. it's a black and white thing when it comes to that. Either it's on or off. No censorship, or you have censorship.
Yeah.
Because once you turn on censorship, that's a subjective thing. What is censored, what needs to be censored in your eyes may not be the same for me.
Yeah. And I remember talking to Brad, the CEO of Unstoppable Domains, about this exact topic a while back. And
what did he say?
I'm pretty sure, I don't want to quote him exactly, but he was just like, that's just how the freedom of speech works. Like, everybody should have a voice. Everybody should be able to put things out on this decentralized internet. They should have the ability to say what they want to say. And it's still like, we didn't nail down anything about, like, what you said with pedophiles and hate speech and all that, like, disgusting stuff that exists on the dark web and out there. And it's one of those things that no one will ever have a concrete answer to say, like, yeah, let's allow all these people to just post whatever they want. No, I haven't ever heard anybody completely confirm that they believe that's the best route to allow like this crap to be out there. No one will put their foot in their mouth, no matter how many people I interview and talk to about it. No one will agree to do it, and rightfully so. I mean, it's just such a bleak subject, you know, like it's not good to have that stuff floating around.
No, it's not. It's not. But you know, again, how do you censor one? You know, it's just weird. And I don't know if it's something that we'll ever see fully occur, where we're just fully decentralized, free markets, unregulated. You know,
I do like the DPoS concept, like what I was talking about with Icon. Yeah. I like EOS. I like that concept of, like, these people are voted into power other than the exchanges, you know, but I think that it is a cool digital nation kind of idea where
they're close. Yeah. That concept is the closest so far that I've seen. It still has its issues, but it's the closest I've seen from a consensus algorithm. Yeah. It's very close to being really, really good. Like, it's on the brink of it, because I like that 21, 22, however you program it, but you got a set of people that are kind of the main VPs. But at any point, if the rest of the network combines and, you know, comes together, they can vote any of those 21 out.
That's right.
So I like that.
That's right. Like with a quick vote,
they can 2 minutes.
They can move a qualified representative out.
But that, again, that sounds good on paper, but then we see it in action, i.e. EOS. And I thought, you know, I'm like, well, why haven't we gotten a lot of these top 21 BPs that come out of nowhere, essentially buy their way into the top ranking? Why haven't we as a community gotten rid of them? And then I thought, there's no economic incentive for the voter necessarily to vote. A lot of people don't vote because there's no economic incentive, you know? Mm-hmm. So then those types of elements play, you know, into the whole equation. And you just kind of see how in the real world, how these things actually operate. And they don't play out the way it is in the white paper.
Yeah. And I agree with you that is the closest or the bleeding edge of innovation in the space from mm-hmm. what I can see. Like, there's some really cool and brilliant people working on that. Mm-hmm. And they're actually doing cool stuff.
Governance is going to be the hardest part of any blockchain.
Yeah. And one of the things it brought up on the Richard Hart stream was, he said, who are these representatives? Why are they qualified to make these decisions? And, you know, I made the case that it is like very democratic, like they're being voted in by the community. And he was just saying, like, they're not technical, like you don't know their backgrounds, things like that. Like, some of the team may or may not be qualified to be voting for projects to get funded and develop on the network and stuff like that. But I think it's more than reasonable to think that for the first few of these programs like Icon and EOS and stuff like that that are rolling out.
Well, what is his solution?
He wasn't coming with solutions.
Okay, so if you don't give me a solution, you can't criticize another one.
Yeah, exactly.
In my opinion. And that's what I would have thought. I'm like, what is your solution? If you don't have a solution, you can't sit up here on, you know, and criticize one another.
Yeah.
Because there is no, I haven't heard of one that's better.
That's right. That's right. And that was part of the reason that I got involved in it so deeply. Like, I became one of the public representatives.
Because I can say the same thing about proof of stake. I mean, proof of work. Who's qualified? You're not qualified to, just because you have a whole bunch of money. I mean, you buy a whole bunch of equipment and you set up a warehouse. All right. Does that mean you're qualified? Does that mean you're trustworthy?
Yeah.
I don't know.
A good point. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm still a big fan of proof of work. I know that a lot of people argue about the environmental impact and things like that, but I love the economics that Bitcoin brings to the table with the labor going into, all of it. I think that it's a beautifully designed system.
The issue to me with POS is that it's, I don't know how scalable it is.
Proof of stake?
I mean, yeah, proof of work, proof of stake, yeah. I don't know how scalable it is from an environmental standpoint, you know, more so. And, you know, you start, it's like, it's exponential in its, you know, it's in its path as far as difficulty. You know, you start going 10, 20 years out, you're going to need the technology. On the hardware side, has to keep up. And then you have the whole situation with quantum computing.
Yeah.
How's that going to play into it? We didn't get a chance to talk about that. Maybe I'll have you back on to talk about quantum computers, qubits, and the whole quantum supremacy. Because I guess there was some article that came out that talked about, I don't know if it was Google or some other company. I think it was Google because they just came out and said they had reached quantum supremacy. But essentially, there was some article saying that they could mine so much Bitcoin with these, hypothetically or theoretically, mine all these Bitcoins so fast with this quantum chip that it would move the difficulty rate so high and pass everyone else or something. It was something, some crazy scenario. And then Andreas was like, well, if quantum computers can hack SHA-256 or whatever, then mining Bitcoin is the least of our issues because all of our internet is, you know, secured by this kind of SHA-256, you know, 512 algorithm.
Yeah, and so, quantum could just like decrypt.
Right? Yeah, it could. But again, he didn't really address the whole situation with Bitcoin and quantum. So I don't know, man. I don't know how's it going to pan out. We'll have to see. It's all still, man, relatively new if you look at it. 10 years is nothing, you know.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest experiments to ever exist for the financial industry. Totally greatest experiment ever.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Well, I got my man here. That was a great conversation, Steve. Thank you for coming on. Any last notes? Last thoughts?
No, thanks. Thanks for having me on, man. I'm excited to do it again, hopefully before another year passes. But
right.
I think we've been in this space for a long time, and it is it's a wild ride. So everybody just hodl on and don't get distracted by all the things that come and go. A lot of things are going to come and go. So just stick to the fundamentals.
There you go. It's your boy Crypto Blood. That's another Kicking It session with my man Steve McGarry.
That is it for my interview with Crypto Blood. I hope you guys like it. If you did, slap a like. If you guys are new here, don't forget to subscribe.